Crafting Stories for Stage. Quick, what contemporary play has now eclipsed A Midsummer's Night Dream as the play most often produced by high school and community theaters? The answer? A play called Almost Maine by John Cariani, who grew up in Presque Isle. Cariani is not the only playwright with ties to Maine putting this state on the Playhouse map. Others are seeing their work staged in theaters across the country and even abroad. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with three Maine playwrights whose work is seeing a broad audience: John Cariani, Monica Wood, and Brent Ascari. We'll ask them what contemporary theater producers are looking for, how they go about crafting their characters and stories, and what they hope their work means for their audience. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Maine has produced some wonderful playwrights over the years, and we are fortunate to have three of them here with us today to share their stories with us and to talk about what goes into the creation of a play. Joining me in our studio, Monica Wood, a best-selling author. Her books include When We Were the Kennedys, and she is also a playwright. Her most recent work, Half-Light, premiered at Portland Stage last year. She grew up in Mexico, Maine. John Cariani is a Tony Award-nominated actor who has been on stage and in movies and on television. He's also an accomplished playwright. His best-known play, Almost Maine, is one of the most produced plays in the country and is currently playing at Portland Stage Company. And John is performing in it. John grew up in Presque Isle. And Brent Ascari is an actor, screenwriter, novelist, and playwright, and a member of the company at Mad Horse Theater in South Portland now, right?
South Portland.
Yeah, I had Portland written down. His most recent play is American Underground. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you seen any of the plays by our panelists or by other Maine playwrights? Do you have questions about what goes into writing a play? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here. I've been looking forward to this all week and going to see your play, John, on Saturday night. Cannot wait.
Great.
I was thinking as I was thinking about this program, two of you are actors and playwrights, and one of you got into playwriting late in the game after writing novels. And I'm wondering how that's different. You know, I'm actually kind of thinking, Monica, it might in a weird way be harder for you because, you know, your novels, you don't like have exit stage left and, instructions on where the actor should be as well as the dialogue. How did you make that transition?
Well, I actually thought it was easier to write a play than a novel. And John, I'm sure you'll weigh in because he just did a novel of Almost Maine.
Okay.
And called me in a panic at one point, twice actually.
Yep.
Yeah.
The other way around. Okay.
So it is actually easier because, I mean, the bad news is you have only one tool to use, and that's dialogue. But that's also the good news because it just streamlines the process so much. And Brent also has written novels in prose, so we can all speak to that same thing. But I just want to add one thing is that I feel, even though I'm not an actor, I have learned so much about acting from just the two plays that I've done at Portland Stage, because I talk to the actors a lot. I watch them really closely. They love talking about process and technique. So I feel like, you know, if some disaster happened and suddenly I had to go on stage for some reason, I think I could do it without disgracing myself.
I think you could do it too, actually.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I've been part of some private play readings where Monica's read, and I think we have a secret. Yeah. Excellent actor.
Okay, great. I can't wait to see you on stage, Monica.
Oh, well, okay, I'll let you know.
Okay, so, but I want to back up a little bit. John, you know, you grew up in Presque Isle, Maine. Did you always know you wanted to be a playwright?
No, actually, great story. When I was in junior in high school, we were reading The Cherry Orchard in my English class, and we took a field trip to Portland Stage Company to see their production, professional production of A Cherry Orchard.
So a school bus from Presque Isle to Portland.
Yep, I think we left at 3:30 in the morning. And we took the long trip down back when the speed limit was 55. And
boy.
I remember it was cold, so it was still winter. And it kind of made me think, I didn't think I wanted to be an actor or a playwright, but I thought, I want to do that. Whatever they're doing up there, I want to do. It was the first professional play I had ever seen. I had seen musicals in my community theater and stuff like that, but I'd never seen a professional play. And I think at that moment I thought, geez, I like this, whatever it is. And that was the beginning.
What a wonderful story.
Good story, right?
What about you?
Arts education.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, and I love the,
did
the other kids in your class feel the same way, or are they doing spitballs on the bus?
No, well, we love the trip down, like that's fun, you know, but we also had great teachers who talked to us about the play on the way down, and then talked to us about the play on the way back. Also seeing people live was really exciting. And also there was a soap opera star in it, and I think some of our parents knew who that soap opera actor was. So that was also exciting for us, is to see someone who was famous.
Okay.
Well, who we thought was famous. Do you know what I mean?
Brent, when did you know you wanted to write plays?
It was relatively late. I think the thing that I used to do when I was young was more, I was a big fan of things like Saturday Night Live and SCTV. So my friends and I were always putting on skits. I remember in fourth grade putting on a fake newscast for the entire school. So that was really my interest. And it was later in life, probably around college, when I started getting interested in theater.
Uh-huh. And when did you make that, though? I mean, I love to watch theater, but boy, terrifying to think, could I write that?
Yes. I'm still terrified thinking. I mean, that has not changed. I think it's that desire to, I'm somebody that always was growing up living in my own imagination, my own head, and the desire to kind of get that out of your head and get it on a stage. And I never get tired of the thrill. I don't know about these guys, but to have these characters that you've thought up in your head, and all of a sudden they're real people pretending that they're the people in your head, and then they're real people watching people pretending. It's an incredible feeling.
And they become real because people become emotionally invested in these
exactly.
people. You know?
Right. And I'm thinking too that writing can be such a solitary thing, a way of living your life that, like you said, Monica, being at the rehearsals and interacting with the actors and the producers and the director must just be a joy.
It's so much more than a joy. And it's the exact opposite.
Yes.
Of just being locked in your little writing place, tapping away on the keys. It's a completely different experience.
Because you get to share the goal. After 2 weeks of work, you can say, I want to share some scenes and I want to read them with my friends. That's what we get to do.
Now, you guys have, and I'm quoting here, you guys have made it in an era where it's hard to make it as a contemporary playwright. You know, I know that many theater companies are staging the same plays over and over that our parents' generation did and generations before, whether it's Shakespeare or Our Town. I mean, in plays like this, what do you think is the secret to getting a play staged today, especially over and over again, as almost Maine has? I mean, John, unbelievable the number of times your play has been staged around the country, thousands.
Well, honestly, I'll tell you honestly what I think it is. I think that there are rural representation in contemporary American art and culture is either pretty much non-existent or not very dimensional. Most of the stories that we tell about rural America have to do with who they voted for president, what they're dealing with in their communities as far as drugs go and depression. And I think that while much of rural America is in a transition period, just because a difficult time is being had by all doesn't mean that there's a joylessness. And that's why I feel like people think there's a joylessness to having a hard life. And that's just not how it goes. When you're having a hard life, you still go have fun. You know what I mean? I'm interested in multidimensional representation of people who live in rural places. And I didn't know I was interested in that, but that's what I write about, you know?
So do you think that community theater directors all over the country pick up your play and say, finally?
Well, somebody told me there are 70 million Americans who live in rural parts, there are 70 million rural Americans. That's a lot of people who are excited to see, you know, and we're in a time where people want to see themselves and people are saying they're excited to see themselves. You know, I had a kid tell me my dad works in a paper mill, and somebody in your play works in a paper mill. So I told my class what it was like to work in a paper mill. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. And speaking of somebody in your play works in a paper mill, we're talking to Monica Wood, and your characters, some of them work in paper mills. I know that your plays have had a great reception here in Maine, and I know that it was really powerful for you, Monica, to see people from your hometown seeing your plays. But they've also had a great reception in other places.
Well, Papermaker's been done a few times hither and yon, but I wouldn't say it's, you know, it takes a really long time, as these guys know, for a play to really find its footing elsewhere.
Sure, almost being 16 years old, right?
Yeah, and it didn't really become what it is till recently.
Go ahead, Monica.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. So, and I do think, unfortunately, the places that I want to see Papermaker done in places like the Rust Belt, and, you know, it had a couple of really beautiful productions in two different places in upstate New York, and it's places that have known the sting of industrial change.
Yes.
But I also think it's important for people who don't live in those areas to see plays like mine and like yours, and
there's not a lot
of
interest.
It's important for them to see that. Yeah. So it's we're in a funny place right now.
So, John, what you're saying is you're finding, even though Almost Maine is now the most produced play in America, it's still not being produced in New York and Los Angeles as much as it is in small communities.
It is occasionally, but I think there's just there's a little bit of it. The fact is that theater is not a rural art form. Theater is an urban art form. So, of course, you're dealing with speaking to... I don't think a lot of New Yorkers know that if you're seeing a play with a lot of subway jokes, that's a form of community theater. That is only going to speak to New Yorkers.
Oh, that is so true.
And that is a problem, because when you make a subway joke in the middle of Kansas, I don't think people are going to quite get the joke the way New Yorkers are going to, you know?
Brent, your plays are, from what I understand, dark humor and a little political. Now, this is what I've read about them.
Yeah, they are absolutely
would you say that's
hilarious.
And your most recent dealing with... well, tell me about America Underground.
American Underground is it's a sort of dystopic vision of a future America where there's a new underground railroad helping American Muslims to get out of the country because they're being persecuted and put in camps. And so it's a nightmarish sort of thriller about where, you know, a possible future.
What's your process? How do you come up with that idea and make it happen?
Well, for that, I come from a mixed race family. My mother's side of the family is from here in Maine and is sort of WASP Episcopalians. And my father is from Iran and is a Shiite Muslim. And as things, I never saw myself as writing a play like that. I really didn't consider myself a political playwright. But until about 4 or 5 years ago, things happening in the country, I basically was having my own nightmarish visions and was very nervous about the conversation and the tenor in the country and about what could possibly happen to people that were my family members or friends. And I think as writers, writing about these things a lot of times is a form of therapy. And I found I had so much of this fear and concern in my head that the natural conclusion was to write about it, because it was inside me, and I just had to sort of exercise these visions.
And you've also written novels and plays, which is more satisfying for you.
Well, I think, you know, along the lines of what we were talking about, the great thing about plays is, as writers, there's this solitary process, and it's so I love being collaborative with other artists, and that is the true thrill. So I get more pleasure out of writing plays.
You're going to jump in, John. I could tell.
Oh no! Just the collaborative nature of theater is pretty special, and the solitary nature of writing novels isn't quite special for me. I had a hard time.
So I just need to note that there was an extraordinary review of American Underground when it was performed in Barrington, Rhode Island. Was it Rhode Island?
Barrington. It's in Western Massachusetts.
Western Massachusetts. Yeah. That makes sense because this this reviewer Peter Bergman says. Everyone needs to see this play. So congratulations
on
that.
It was great. I went out to see it. My husband and I went out to see it. And it was, I had my heart, I was telling John on the way over here, I had my heart in my throat the whole time. It's so tense and suspenseful and well done. And you had a really good cast, too, which is always a relief for a play, right? Because you never know.
I was actually going to ask that question. I'll turn it to you, John. Have you ever seen one of your plays performed by a cast that was just not very good? I mean...
I don't really think of it that way because I think once you start watching your play, you kind of know what you're dealing with, whether it's high school students, inexperienced people, people who aren't quite right for the play. I tend to just hope that the stories are heard because I remember when I was growing up, I saw a production of at my community theater of The Glass Menagerie, and I loved it. I thought it was one of the most amazing stories I'd ever heard, and I thought the production was incredible. And I talked to one of my friends who was in it, and she said, John, we were probably really bad because we aren't really that good. And I was like, that's interesting because I don't remember you being bad at all. You know, so I think if the story's strong enough, then it can – I like sturdy stories. I prefer action to character. I love good – I think plays are compilations of action, and I like that because I think plot is super important. And
will you build a scene around something you want to happen? You envision something happening on the stage and you think, how am I going to work this into a play?
I dream about things. I think kisses between people who aren't hot are awesome. Like love stories with not hot people are what I'm really interested in.
Okay, what about you, Monica? What's going on in your mind as you're thinking about building a scene?
What I try to do is write line to line lines that actors would love to get their tongue around. That's what I... And I think that if you pay attention to each line of dialogue that... And John, you mentioned plot. I mean, I have seen so many plotless plays, and they're just not very interesting. I don't know when it became
not my thing.
The rule that plots don't have to be in anything.
It's a trend.
It's the, but it's the... That's what we go to hear a story. And a story, generally speaking, has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I don't think that's too much to ask.
Well, I think a lot of reviewers are scared of plot right now. They think it's old-fashioned. And what they don't realize is that they don't criticize plot when it's a brilliant plot. And it's the hardest part of what we do. Making a good, believable plot is the hardest part.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah. And if it's a bad plot, people think that plot is outdated. We don't need it anymore. And if it's fantastic, people think it's the most beautiful play or book they've ever read.
How important are reviewers?
It depends on where it is. I think a reviewer can really. When Papermaker played in at Penobscot Theater in Bangor, it was really a very lovely production. But the reviewer and there's only one, and there were a few others, a little small papers, but the big one, the Bangor Daily, the person just did not like the play, and I think it really affected the run of the play. So when it's in a small place. And there's one main review, it does affect it. I think in larger places, I don't know. I mean, maybe New York, maybe those guys still have
I would like
influence.
To say, too, that the responsibility of a reviewer at a theater like Penobscot Theater Company dealing with a play that is dealing with the issues that play is dealing with, working with a writer like Monica Wood, I think that you have to consider what you're saying in your review a little more carefully. Mm. That makes me sad that would happen. Because I don't think reviewers know how damaging that can be for the future life of the play also.
I want to talk, you talked about trend, John, and I want to come back to that theme, but we do need to take a break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Impeachment, sucking up a lot of political oxygen, but it's not the number one question in Iowa.
The number one question for most is, can I see this person defeating Donald Trump? Can I see this person as a good president?
We took a trip to the Hawkeye State. Hear what we found next time on The Takeaways Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC and PRX.
That's this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. You're listening to Maine Public Radio's regular schedule stream. While on air, we are carrying live NPR coverage of the Senate impeachment trial. That will continue until 4 this afternoon, when All Things Considered will be on the air with the day's full news. Please note, if you'd like to watch the Senate impeachment trial, Maine Public Television, both the Maine and World channels, are offering coverage from the PBS NewsHour. And we have a visual stream on our website, mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, I'm talking with three Maine playwrights about their work. My guest, John Cariani, actor and playwright, who is currently on stage in his own play, Almost Maine. Brent Ascari writes plays and novels and also acts. His recent play is American Underground. And Monica Wood is an author and playwright. Her most recent play is Half Light. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I'm going to go to Martin, who posted on Facebook, "We're blessed to have City Theater in Biddeford, which now routinely sells out the 275-seat venue." So there's a lot of local support.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
"As Maine playwrights, do you hope to see your production staged at home, or does it feel like more of an achievement to put them on around the world?"
Wow.
I think just having it produced feels like an achievement.
Honestly.
I
have to say that of all the productions I've seen of Papermaker, the one that I will never, ever, ever forget going to was at Oxford Hills in Maine, and it was community theater. So these are not, you know, professional actors, but the people in the audience were all from that area. They knew this story so well. They'd all gone through paper strikes, and it was, you know, not the most sophisticated audience maybe, but they were so there and so with it. And there was a talk. I was there, so there was a talk back afterwards. And not one single person left at the end. Every single person
stayed
for the talk back.
Yeah, no kidding.
Which I didn't know if maybe they thought they weren't supposed to leave.
No.
That was possible.
Right.
But it was so, and it was really, they were all just kind of testifying. Like, oh, yes, I remember this, I remember that. It was so deeply moving to me.
Well, and it's interesting you say that because, you know, we all learned that Shakespeare was for the people. I mean, this wasn't an elitist thing, you know. And how come theater has gotten to this place where we think it's elitist? Is it because the tickets cost more than the movie theater?
Yes.
That's a big part of it.
Yeah. So beforehand, John, you mentioned that one of the trends out there is a plotless play. What are other trends? What are things that you all are either happy about or sort of like, oh, gosh, I can't wait for this trend to go away in what is being produced in theater?
Well, I'll just start. A couple years ago, I was walking around with my friend, a friend of mine who's a wonderful actress, and we passed Angels in America on Broadway, Torch Song Trilogy on Broadway, and Boys in the Band on Broadway. Three major plays, all revivals of gay male plays. And she said, "Where are the women? Where are the queer women in theater?" And I thought, wow, I have never thought about that. And she went on to talk about how powerful men, gay men, are in the theater. Their stories have been told, are being told, will continue to be told. And she said, "Where are the women?" And that led me to wonder, Queerness and race are the two big issues right now, I would say, in the American theater. They're not the only issues that are affecting the world, but they're the two big issues that the powers that be in the New York theater scene I seem to be most interested in. And I think that's great, but I would like to see some queerness set in a rural area.
Mm.
And you don't see that. It's all urban all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to see, I think people don't understand what poverty is and how poverty affects so much of the country. I had a kid say to me recently that she didn't believe that there was any such thing as poor white people because she grew up in New York City and she never saw any poor white people in New York City. And then she went to college at a liberal arts college in Massachusetts and started tutoring in the schools. And her first student was a white boy who didn't have a winter coat. And she got him a coat. And she did not know that that existed. And I said, well, it does. And that's
what
I want.
That sounds like a terrific character or scene in a play, doesn't it?
But that really moved me. And that's only anecdote. I just learned that anecdotes, anecdotes don't make data. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
But I think anecdotes are still important because they are a truth.
Right.
But I think that was important. That made me realize something about what people from cities think about the flyover states, the hinterlands. Do you know what I mean? So
right. And John, do you live in New York now?
I
so
do.
You're living these two lives. You grew up in Presque Isle,
yeah,
but living in New York City. So.
And I hear people from both places say pretty lousy things about the other. And I don't like it very much, honestly.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. Monica, what about you? What are you seeing in theater that you are
responding to? I see so many things that I kind of try not to miss anything. So I feel like I've seen so much that it's hard for me even to say what the trends are. I think John's in a way better position than I am to know what that is.
Well, let me ask you this, Brent, because you have a lot of plays under your belt. Mm-hmm. Which of yours are sort of continue to be produced and which do not, and why do you think that is?
Well, I think recently I've had a lot of plays produced dealing with issues of being Middle Eastern in America, because I think that's obviously...
It's relevant now.
It's very relevant. Mm-hmm. And I think... I just want to piggyback on something that, you know, that John, both of these guys were talking about too, in terms of trends, is that I think that, you know, that theater is so much, it seems to be so much dependent on what is successful in New York. And then that is taken as something that sort of then is distributed out to the quote unquote provinces,
yeah,
in a sense. And mm-hmm. that I think, as these guys were saying, like, in a way, Manhattan is probably the worst proving ground for what's going to happen in the rest, for what's going to play in the rest of the country. And I think when you get what's sort of deemed a hot play is sort of decided in Manhattan, I think things tend to have a certain kind of, maybe there's a little bit more cynicism or a little bit more of a sort of urbane sensibility. And I also think like maybe more academic or intellectual, and I think things that have a lot of heart that's not sort of something that I think is very prized in mm-hmm. theater as much as maybe a certain kind of topicality or a certain kind of academic sensibility. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's just my own
Well,
feeling.
I think the powers that be sometimes mistake heart for schmaltz, and it's a huge difference.
Yeah.
A huge difference.
And that's dependent on the team of designers and actors you have, too.
And the script, the
how much
line
are they gonna,
to
yeah,
line.
Yep. And how much are they going to sentimentalize? How much are they mm-hmm. going to, yeah.
I have Travis calling in from Bangor. This is Travis Baker, a playwright. Hi, Travis. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
So if you've been listening to the conversation, do you agree with what our guests are saying about trends in theater?
I have to say I don't really follow the trends, so I can't really comment on that. I write the play that makes sense for me to write at the time. I've had two plays at the Penobscot Theater. One was One Blue Tarp. It was about a guy and his tarp in the town that wants to take it away from him. And then I had another one called...
And Dan Burson directed it, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Dan Burson.
Really good show.
Yeah, and I've worked with Dan a couple times. I'm actually going to be teaching a playwriting workshop with him at Morse High School this month.
Oh, great.
Oh, lucky kids.
But then I had the other play at Penobscot Theater was Hair Frenzy, which was more of a farce about small town hair salon. But then I had the one that I've been working on the last few years is The Dog's Bond, which is about guys up at camp, and four of them are vets, and they're dealing with PTSD. And so, as I told Barry Newport, the artistic director, it may not be the at PTC, that it may not be the play that could get done at the Penobscot Theater, but it's the play I had to write.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think if there's a trend I'd like to see more of in Maine, I think what some of they were talking about is ignoring what's happening in New York, essentially, and writing plays for Mainers about what we're experiencing. And those plays have done, obviously, they've done well for John, and they've done well for me. And I'd like to see... I think community theaters and local theaters do a good job of encouraging their fellow artists to produce writing. And I think they can do a little bit more to promote that beyond, let's do another Agatha Christie murder. Or, you know,
right. Yeah.
I think it's good to bring those works in, experience them, especially from cultures outside of our experience. But
yeah,
I think if there's a trend I'd like to see, it's simply more main plays really addressing what life is like here and not what people imagine it to be.
Well, and Portland Stage has done a really good job. Anita Stewart has done a remarkable job of making sure to program main-based stories, main playwrights. It's really remarkable.
Travis, thanks so much for calling in. That's Travis Baker, who is also a playwright here in Maine. Do you all do what Travis does? A play comes to you and you have to write it? Or how do you make a decision of, like, of all these ideas? You're all really creative people. I'm sure you've got your mind racing with ideas. Of which one are you going to sit down and make stick to page or to computer screen?
Well, I'm certainly not burdened with a plethora of ideas at once. It's really hard to suss out something that you think is going to work. I certainly don't do it, you know, the wrong way around, which is, how is this going to play to such an audience? I just start with a character in trouble of some sort. That's how I start everything I write.
A character in trouble.
Yeah.
Okay, John, where do you start?
The end.
Huh. Always. Oh, you do?
Really?
I like to have an ending to write to.
Oh, interesting.
And if I can just get to that ending, I'll at least get there. If I don't have an ending, I'll start. Inspiration will strike. I'll start, and then inspiration disappears, and I'm lazy and undisciplined, so I won't finish.
I don't believe that.
That's not true.
No, I don't like to work hard. You know what I mean? And it's hard work. It's like you said. You get the great ideas. I'm old enough now to know that the great idea comes, I'm like, oh no, I had this great idea, and now I have to do all this work to make it work.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's really depressing, actually. It is. Don't you agree?
Yeah.
He's like,
is.
Oh,
yeah.
No, I don't want to. Oh, I have this idea. Now I'm going to have to do it.
I know.
It's just going to take time.
I'm working on a novel right now, and this did just sort of a bolt from the blue at the end of the summer. And I remember I was listening to these characters for like several days, and they just like, nee, 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 nee. And I'm like, okay, I'm a playwright now. Go find somebody else. I'm not doing this. And I ended up doing it anyway. So I'm working on a book.
Okay.
And not a play.
Brent, I haven't asked you.
For me, it's usually a premise. It's usually an idea, and a lot of times it's kind of a what if, like, oh, what if that happened? And I'll run it by a bunch of friends, and if people I trust, and if people kind of go like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Oh, do you think you might do that? I'd go see something like that.
Yeah, okay.
Then that's the kind of thing that I'll usually have a bunch of ideas, but usually one idea will start insisting itself and kind of leading a horse race to get done.
I just thought of something. You know, Brent, your plays, if your plays came out 7 or 8 years ago, I think it would be different for you in a way. Because 7 or 8 years ago, there was a lot of interest in the Muslim American story. And that has been trumped by other stories right now. And that's because theater's becoming a very academically controlled art form.
Yes.
And I
kind of like poetry that way, yeah.
Yes.
I might get in trouble for this. I don't think you need to go. I think you need to go to school to learn design elements and design technique, and I think you need to learn how to use your instrument as an actor. So I do think schooling is valuable, but I don't think academics make the best theater artists. And Ben Hecht, the playwright who wrote the movie His Girl Friday, and which was the front page of the play, he said that great theater artists don't have too much cerebration.
I don't know that word.
Cerebration, like cerebral. Cerebration, like the mind. Like cerebral. Because great theater artists report on what burns in the soul and the heart.
Mm.
And as a worker, I don't think I'm an artist. I think I'm a worker, because actors are workers.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I get frustrated with people who operate only from their mind and think that this is an art form that exists from the mind. And it doesn't. This is an art form that exists from the soul and the heart. It's visual. The elements in Almost Maine that I don't understand are visual. I'm not a visual thinker. I don't even know if I respond to visual. I obviously do, but I don't know what I respond to. Anita Stewart designed our set, and from the pictures I saw, it took my breath away. Because I'm up there. I don't know what it looks like. And that's another element of the theater. It's what you can do sonically, what you can do visually. And I just really, I kind of would love to wrest it away from the places that kind of run the run it right now. I'm kind of angry at them.
Well, and I just want to say is...
Because comedy's dying because we're not teaching people how to be funny.
Absolutely.
We're not teaching that it's technique. You know, it's hard work.
It's a skill.
It's not organic every time. When you don't feel like doing it, you've got to go out there and do it. You know, had that last night, I was tired. Had to just technically hit my marks and it worked and then you get going, you know?
Well, and as an actor, I've had the opportunity to act in both plays. In plays by John and Monica, I actually got to do Almost Maine at City Theater, which was just for City Theater
in
Bedford.
Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah.
Did you tell me that?
I don't know.
I don't know.
If I did. But and also in Monica's Half Light, and the experience of being in both those plays is the heart and the emotion and the humor and the connection to the audience. I remember
Upswells.
Upswells. I mean, being in Monica's Half Light, there was moments where you would hear, you know, we're used to hearing audible laughter, but like audible weeping.
Well, because also in Half Light, you're playing a middle-aged person.
Right.
Two people in their midlife having lost, having never found, finding each other. And that story isn't around. Do you know what I mean? Like funny-looking middle-aged people finding some love, you know? Mm-hmm. No offense. I don't think you're funny-looking, Brent. I think I'm also funny-looking. But you know what I mean? Like,
we're going to let Brent think about that over the break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org. We'd love to have your email, but please email quickly as we're coming to the end of the hour. We'll be right back.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On January 24, 1963, a B-52 bomber encountered turbulence strong enough to snap off the vertical stabilizer, causing it to crash onto the side of Elephant Mountain in Piscataquis County. This was the second high-tailed B-52 to suffer such a fatal structural failure. Navigator Gerald Adler survived, along with the pilot, Lieutenant Colonel Dan Bully, after spending 20 hours on the mountainside. In 1998, a memorial stone monument was raised at the site.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park. Happy birthday, Maine!
Northern New England is the oldest place in the nation on average. On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we look at our housing options as we age. From an investigation into inadequate residential care facilities,
where are you going to find a place that is safe?
To a private home for seniors with no rules.
It's been wonderful here. I like it here very much. I don't want to go home and live alone again.
Join us for those stories on Next.
And that's today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the world of playwriting and what goes into it. Joining me, three successful playwrights from Maine, John Cariani, Brent Ascari, and Monica Wood. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. A message here from Phoebe. What are your feelings about writing characters whose lives you've never lived? I'm thinking of different race, gender, social status, life experience. Is it your place to write about things you've never personally experienced?
You know, that's a question right now that's going around not just in playwriting, but in novel writing and in just in the arts in general. And my feeling as an artist myself is you write what you want to write and let whoever's going to read it or see it or hear it make the judgment whether or not you have succeeded. I think that writing is an act of empathy. And by that I mean that you can imagine yourself inside the life of another who is not you. That's what art is for, and that's what it does. So I have no quarrel with people who want to cross over to another gender or race or whatever. Just do it well.
I was just thinking, we all each only have one lived experience, so mm-hmm. that wouldn't make for a multi-character play, even.
No.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
We trade in imagination, and if we Absolutely. Were only limited to our own experience.
I think it's really interesting that in my career in New York, I play Jewish people all the time, and I'm not Jewish, but people think that I am because of what I look like. Mm. And people are stuck with what they look like. We're stuck with it. And I can't help the fact that people always want to cast me as something I'm not at all.
Well, looking at you, John, I'm guessing you could play a whole lot of different people who are different from who you are.
Yeah, but I rarely play guy who grew up in a small town in northern Maine on near farm country. That's not what they're going to cast me as.
Right.
But
he's doing it right
that's
now.
That's what I know.
Yeah, you're doing it right now. Your own play is at Portland Stage Company right now.
Yep.
That's why we're doing the program this week.
Yep.
And you're acting in it.
Yeah.
You're acting in something you wrote a long time ago, in a different part of your life, a different place in your life. What is it like? Do you feel like when you're doing it, like, I'm going to show them how this needs to be done? Or do you even remember writing those words?
Well, I wanted to change some stuff, and Sally Wood, the director, reminded me that I wrote it when I was young. And she said, you don't want to, that's by you when you were young. Let's leave it like that. Mm-hmm. And so we did make some rewrites just to things I'd always kind of wanted to fix, and which will be fixed in the next edition. You're always kind of fixing. You know, you always hear things like, oh, that should be tweaked a little bit. But no, when you go into actor mode, I like to just call it dumbing down. Blank slate, empty vessel, start over, deal with the people you're dealing with, respond to what's given to you, try to drop preconceived notions. I have some ideas of how things ought to go, and sometimes I would tell Sally, you know, this works really well if we keep the pace up, or it works really well if we slow down here, you know, stuff like that. But no, you just, when you're with good people, you just trust them, trust their vision, and let it happen.
Brent, are you also, when you act, I know this is about playwriting, but are you the same thing, empty going in, fill me up?
Yeah, I think that's the best place to operate from. I mean, one of the things I like about acting is that is actually that ability to sort of empty yourself out and inhabit someone else's experience and let that inform your decisions and choices and to leave your own ego behind.
I know that you've acted in one or two of Monica's plays.
One.
And what about John's? Any?
Yeah, the Almost Maine at a Biddeford City Theater, yeah, which was a great experience for me.
Well, I asked Sally Wood, I said, what about Brent in Almost Maine? And she said, he's too much like you. Seriously, because we have a similar way. I call it beta alpha. I don't know, that's what it seems like to me.
Beta alpha?
Yeah, like beta alphas. But she said she wanted to get a completely different type.
Oh.
To contrast me.
So what is beta alpha? Is this sort of like friendly and
somebody
kind?
Told me that like you have some drive, but you're usually
like nice to people.
I guess no. I just like no.
You
sit
nice.
Back a little, right, and listen. Not supremely confident, I guess I would call it.
Okay, we have a tweet. Which play or playwright most influenced them?
Wow. Oh, that's a good one. What do you think, Brent?
Whoever sent that tweet, you've stumped our guess.
I can say right. I mean, there's so many different ones, but as far as a fairly recent, I guess not now. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the Irish playwright Martin McDonagh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, me
best.
Too.
He's somebody that just his blend of
full of
humor.
Action.
Yes, exactly.
And the musicality of the language.
And can be completely outrageous and dark, but then you
makes
have
sense.
These, but an incredible heart in plays like the Cripple of Inishmon, mm-hmm. or, you know. So anyway, he's somebody that I hold up right now.
A question from Lucy. In response to your comments about plot, what do you think about more avant-garde dance theater whose point is to unravel traditional ideas of how a story can be told? Okay, silence.
No, that's a good question.
Yeah, it is.
I think as long as you, I mean, I think the responsibility of any performance art is to engage an audience. And when people say they don't care about their audience, I don't understand that idea. You hear that sometimes. I don't care what people think. Well, the whole point of it is to engage an audience. So I think audiences can be engaged in several different ways. And I know that I'm swept up in, I love going to see dance. Because I don't do it. I don't know how to do it. I marvel at people who can do it. And I just always think it's kind of awesome. You know,
I
and
think
so,
it, yeah,
whatever
any theatrical piece that allows you to feel something, to remember that we're all part of a human family. I think that, for me, that's why I take in theater, to remember how connected we all are. Even if it's a, you know, really you know, the worst of human nature that is being shown in the show, it's still, we're all in this together. This is all part of the human experience. And to me, anything that can get at that works for me.
Well, and it's an obvious point, but we also experience theater collectively. You know, it's not us streaming a Netflix show back at home.
Right.
We experience it with other people, and that is part of the pleasure of that experience.
And I think was it a tweet you said?
Mm-hmm.
But I think to respond to the tweet, whenever people ask me why I like live performance, I'm like, well, because it's athletic for the person doing it. It's hard work. It's a very different kind of work. And there's no screen in between what's happening on the stage and what's happening in the audience. And the difference between theater and other media is you can smell theater and you can't smell the other. So if you're cooking on stage or...
Yeah.
You can smell it. And that's what I think. And you can walk up and touch people if you want to, because it's real.
If I had my druthers, I would see a play every night of my life. And during the run of The Half Light and the run of The Papermaker, I did. I saw every single show. And every single show was different. That's the other thing. It's because it's a different audience. You know, the thing happens between the audience and the actors.
Yes,
that's
where the play happens.
That's where it happens. It's in this...
the air
space.
In between.
Yeah, it's and that is different every single night. Wow.
And you know, I want people to think about this though. People think that if they go see a dance concert, or if they go see a play or some sort of live performance event, and if they don't like it, they think they don't like theater or they don't like live performance. And nobody thinks that if they watch a Netflix show they don't like. You just pause, you stop, you don't watch it anymore, and you watch another show. So I want people to stop thinking that
it's not the theater.
You don't
theater.
Hate the whole form. You just don't like that play.
Right. You don't hate television because you saw poor television.
And nobody says that. Well, I hate TV because I saw that show and I didn't like it. Nobody says that, but I've had people say.
Part of that is the economics. Like, I think if you rent a movie from Netflix, like Redbox, and you don't like it, you're like, all right, I'm out $2.
Yeah.
But if you go pay $60 for a theater ticket, you're like, oh boy, I don't know if I'm going to take that risk again.
Yes, exactly.
So I want to ask you all, before we run out of time, what advice do you have to someone who thinks they might like to try to write a play?
Well, if you think you want to do it, do it. Don't just think about it. Do it.
How do you do it?
Show up every morning. Get up 2 minutes in the morning. That's all I do. I'm lazy. I'm undisciplined. I have to make myself do 2 minutes in the morning, because if I do 2 minutes, I'll do it. Even 10 minutes, I'm like, ah, I don't want to do that. 2 minutes, I'll do. Once you get started, it can turn into 10 minutes, an hour, 2 hours. Even if, and the other thing is, like, if I go to church and the homily's boring or something, I work on my play. I go to lectures if they're awesome. Mm-hmm. I'm interested. I'm learning something. If it's boring, I work on my play. So I go for long walks without your phone, and you'll work on your play. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think for any writing you're doing, it's the writing habit. It's touching it at least once a day.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to write only on weekends or only, and I know that people have day jobs. I mean, we're lucky we can do this, but if you just touch it once a day, so you're always, it's always with you, then it will get done.
How do you get your plays out there? Brent, I know you enter a lot of contests, don't you?
Yeah, a lot of, and apply for development opportunities. I think, and here in Maine, there are organizations, I think it's so important for, as a playwright, to get your work up in front of people, and there are things like the Portland Fringe Festival, the Crowbait Club, which incubates 10-minute plays, the Maine Playwriting Festival, which John is the artist in residence this year.
And you have a play in it this year?
Yep, yeah, I have a play in it as well. Yeah, and it's there are these organizations I would encourage people to seek out, to connect with other theater artists and other playwrights and get your work in front of people, because that's how we learn. The audience tells us everything.
And don't think that obstacles are special. They're the norm. Obstacles, obstacles, obstacles in your way all the time. So don't even be upset about it. Just get used to it. That's what I would say.
And the other thing is, if you're an aspiring playwright, go to plays. Go to every play. We have plenty of low-cost opportunities in Maine to go see plays.
Okay, well, this is how I'm going to wrap up. Anna Gravel posted on Facebook with a picture of her baby listening to Brent Ascari, Monica Wood, and John Cariana talk about theater and playwriting, and Maine Calling is giving me life right now.
Aww.
I'm doing important work raising my little firecracker,
but
to say I miss this world is a massive understatement.
Yeah.
So I suspect this is someone you all know.
Yes.
Thank you.
She's terrific.
Well, thank you all for joining us and here on Maine Calling on this Winter Friday. Monica Wood, best-selling author and playwright. Her most recent play is Half Light. John Cariani, actor, playwright, and performing in his own play, Almost Maine, right now at Portland Stage Company, and Brent Ascari, actor, playwright, novelist. His recent play, his most recent play, American Underground. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandreau. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Just letting you know that next week, Maine Public Radio will continue broadcasting the Senate impeachment trial over the air. You will still be able to hear Maine Calling by going to our website. We are streaming all of our regular programming at mainepublic.org. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.